92.3 Inspiration FM, Nigeria's number one. Okay, it's 92.3 Inspiration FM. Welcome to the show. It's Under the Sun. Now, this show is brought to you by British Council. And basically, for the next couple of weeks, we're going to be bringing you some short stories which have been edited and put into a very, how should I put it, very interactive way. Now, it's called a radiophonic. And first up this afternoon is called The Death of Innocence. This was written by Justina Chita Iruebu, and we'll be playing that in a couple of minutes. So just sit back, relax. I also have a guest in the house. I'm sure he would like to say hi. Hello, Mr. Francis.
Hello, Nigeria.
Francis, are you okay?
I'm very well, thank you.
Okay, you can move up to the mic. I can't really hear you too well.
Okay.
Okay, better. So you're relaxed, you're ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
You're ready. Yeah. Okay, we'll be giving you a brief info on who Francis is, what he does, and why exactly he's in the studio. Now, Under the Sun features the best of contemporary Nigerian writing brought to you by the British Council. The series was devised by Graham Mort and produced by Chidi Okwu. All right, so sit back, relax. I'm going to play you our first of the many coming your way, Under the Sun. This one is titled The Death of Innocence, written by Justina Chita Iruebu. Enjoy.
It was a cold night, like any other night, with the world fast asleep. The sky was heavy. A thick black cloud moved slowly like a fetus in the womb. The stillness of the night was disturbed by the creak of the iron door. Three pairs of feet crept into the kitchen, avoiding everything in their way. There was a crash. A plate dropped, shattering into tiny pieces. We stood still, held our breath, waited for someone to make a move. No sound was heard. We crept forward. Once in the living room, we split in different directions. I tiptoed up the stairs and headed for the master bedroom. The door was half closed. I peeped in. A dim blue light welcomed my eyes. I walked to the bedside, where two forms were sleeping under a sheet, peacefully in each other's arms. I watched their faces for a while, hoping that they would not be stubborn in handing over the silver briefcase. Then I tapped the man hard on his shoulder. "My friend, stand up!" He started up and stared at me as if I were an apparition. He looked lost, as if it was all a dream. His eyes left my face, landing on the gun in my hand. "La ilaha illallah." The words fell out of his mouth. Forbidden words. They landed like a missile in my ears. My brain was touched by the alarm those words set off. My blood turned hell hot. I pulled the trigger without a thought, sending a bullet straight into his head. The shot woke the woman by his side. An owl cried outside. I cocked the pistol again. Before the woman could begin her plea, I silenced her. My colleagues came rushing into the room, knowing full well how I could behave in situations like this. But they made a mistake. They came in with the rest of the family. Enraged, I fired blindly, first at the young girl, next an old woman, and I froze in mid-action. The boy, about 11 years, had wet himself. Sweat glistened off his face. His mouth was agape. As I stared at him, gun in hand, cocked and ready to fire, the world stopped moving in my head. The silence in the room became deafening. The screeching of tires followed by gunshots jolted all back to life. Someone might have alerted the police. Instincts told us we needed to disappear from that room. Jakala jumped through the window. Cobra took the back door. But I just stood there, looking from the dead bodies around me to the 11-year-old. His tear-filled eyes stared me in the face. I broke loose from his gaze and absentmindedly groped around the house looking for... I didn't even know. I had never been so destabilized in my 6 years in this enterprise. Taking lives, especially in cold blood, had become some sort of sport that I had come to enjoy. The same way football fans enjoy football. The storm of bullets, punctuated by cries from those hit, reminded me that I was still in enemy territory. I pulled myself together and made to run. Just then,
"Drop your weapon or I fire!"
My gun fell from my hand and my limbs went numb. The next thing I remembered was the hard knocking of my head against the vehicle as it moved on steadily, avoiding potholes. I looked around me. I realized for the first time that I was sitting in a pool of blood, the blood of my associates, as their bodies lay motionless. Then something else struck me, the horrified face of that 11-year-old boy. The look on that face catapulted me back to the place I dreaded so much to return to. It's been 6 years now, but I can still recall the horror like it happened yesterday. Back then in Kano, my best friend Karim and I were returning from school. It was about 4:20 p.m. on that fateful day. We were playing football with a little plastic ball I picked up at school. Karim loved football. He dreamed of one day becoming a big star like JJ Okocha. I loved football too, but my father, who was an architect, he wanted me to be a doctor. I didn't know if I wanted to be a doctor. After all, I was just 11. One thing I knew was that I was fascinated by aeroplanes and would one day like to work inside one. Yes, that was my dream, to be a pilot.
"Uche, pass the ball now," Karim beckoned to me. "Uh-uh, are you not Okocha again? Come and collect it," I shouted back.
A car sped past us. The driver warned us to leave the road. At this time, we were close to our street. We continued our game until I noticed something unusual. "Karim, why is everywhere so quiet?" "I don't know, but..." Karim stopped. He looked up. "See, is that not smoke coming from that house?"
"Smoke?"
"Yes, the house is burning. Come, let us go and..." I wasn't listening anymore. My mind went straight to my family. My father should be at home because he was on leave from work. My mother definitely was at home. She was a caterer and she did her business from the house. My younger sister Agnes would be back from school, and my baby brother Obinna was just 8 months old. As these thoughts went through my mind, my legs began to run. I ran past the burning houses and shops. Our street, which bubbled with life, seemed deserted, quiet like a graveyard. Our street was in the heart of Kano, in a suburb mostly inhabited by northerners. Our neighbors were quite friendly until this crisis started. Since then, we rarely left the house. When either my father or mother wanted to go out to get anything, they wore traditional northern attire, and because they spoke the language very, very well, they got along. So many people from the east had already left Kano for safety, but my father told us that it was very risky to even travel. Many who left never got home, as they were massacred on the way. Besides, I was writing my exams and he wouldn't want me to stop schooling. He had lived here all his life. Kano had become home and we felt very safe. Until now. I sprinted as fast as my legs could carry me. The road now seemed so far. On getting to the bend that led to my house, I saw thick smoke. My heart missed a beat. And then I came face to face with reality. A raging fire burning my house. First, I was lost as to what was happening. Then I heard voices wailing from inside the fire. I made to run to the flames, but a hand held me back. It was Karim who had run after me. I felt other hands holding me back. I struggled and struggled until the last strength in me faded. While they held me, my father, mother, sister and brother burned to ashes in that house right in front of me. Just that morning, my family had been intact, and now I was orphaned. I closed my eyes tightly, hoping to wake up from the nightmare. Karim's hand on my back reminded me it wasn't a dream. He wanted to take me away from the smoldering heap, but I wouldn't let him. My sorrow knew no bounds. I sat there. I sat there for 2 days without food or water. My young mind couldn't understand the basis of such cruelty from people we lived with, ate with, talked with, and played with. Worse still, I had never visited my hometown and knew no relatives. So I had nowhere to go. Looking at that ruin killed the child in me. My heart became cold, stone cold. Hatred and bitterness filled my stomach. I yearned for revenge like air, the air that I breathe. Karim's mother, a kind-hearted woman, tried to sneak me into their house at night so I could eat something and have a place to lay my head. But I didn't want her pity, for she was one of them, one of the people who had murdered my innocence. If this crisis is ever over, I thought, as I stood up from the heap of that ruin 3 days later, it will be only for those who lost nothing. But for me, it would be far from over. It would be just the beginning of war. Those words filled my heart as I began to walk away, to nowhere.
My friend, stand well, well.
The court usher's voice jerked me back to reality. I realize I was slumping. I look around. Everyone is staring at me, some in pity, some in confusion. In an attempt to avoid their eyes, I glance at the clock. 3:15 p.m. I must have been standing in that courtroom for 4 hours. The judge seems busy with her writing. What will the judgment be? Sincerely, I don't care. I don't even feel sorry for what I have done. I lost the luxury of such feeling that day in Kano 6 years ago. My thought drifts off again to where I could have been now. In the university, maybe, studying to either be a doctor, as my father wanted, or a pilot. But here I am at the University of Society, where at 17, after going through rigorous lectures on the streets and under the bridges, I am already a graduate of crime and murder, with first-class honors. Someone walking towards me brings me back to reality. It is that familiar face again. The 11-year-old boy whose family I killed on that cold night. He smiles at me and hands me a white handkerchief. Everyone watches in silence. I stare at him in confusion. A sign of peace from a child whose parents I killed. I cannot understand it, and for the first time in 6 years, tears well up in my eyes, just as the judge exhales deeply in readiness to give her judgment.
Okay, people, so there you have it. The Death of Innocence, written by Justina Chita Irebu. And basically, that's just talking about a child's family massacred in Kano for tribal differences. The son abandons his dream of becoming a pilot, becomes a gangster instead, and starts killing and robbing. Now, I had a chat with Justina not too long ago, a radio call, and basically threw some questions at her and found out what she had to say about her story. Here's Justina with the phone call.
My name is Justina Chesachuku Irebu from Abia State.
What was your inspiration behind this story? Was it factual or fiction?
Well, a little more, in fact, more factual than it is fiction, because there was a project I was doing which I called the dehumanization of a growing generation. Because I've been studying this thing about ethnic clashes, religious clashes. And most times, even when the polity or the society or government wants to address the issue, they really talk about the children. So for me, it's more like the adage where they said, I went through elephants fight. It is actually the grass that suffers the most.
Okay. Now, the son that abandons his dream and becomes a gangster, would you hold the boy responsible for his actions, or would you hold the fact that his family got killed? Who would you hold for whatever this boy does from...
I hold the society responsible. I hold them responsible. Because if that child's education and family has not been truncated and the child has to be a witness of it, he didn't cause it. He didn't cause any fight. He didn't know what the cause of the fight was anyway.
If the society is responsible for making the child who he is and the child goes out and starts killing as a form of rebellion, don't you think this is just a vicious cycle? When or where does the cycle break?
Oh, well, after the point society begins to address these issues, I think it's about rehabilitation for this set of people and more or less stopping this cycle. Is there nothing that can be done by society or by government to stop once and for all of these ethnic clashes and all of these religious clashes?
Now, do you believe that some children are beyond rehabilitation? They've been damaged psychologically so bad that there's no hope for them?
No, I do not believe that there is anybody in life that there is no hope for. There is hope for everybody. We just have to try. Have we tried at all? What have we done? What have we adults done? What have society done to salvage the situation? Maybe you're in Lagos. These children are all over the place, roaming the streets. Who is saying anything? Who is helping? I don't think we have come to the point whereby we say we have tried and then there is no hope. I do not believe that there is no hope.
What instances of rehabilitation have you seen and have you seen work?
Well, the few I have heard about is mostly NGOs or FBOs, that is churches, coming to do one thing or the other. But most of these things are actually, you know, short-lived. You know, they are not continuous. Maybe an FBO comes up with a program, they do something for the kids. Sometimes they don't, it's not long-lasting. You know, they just do it for a little while, get some publicity, okay, this is what I'm doing good. Sometimes it doesn't last, but the ones that last long, they work. At least I've heard about a child who was picked from the street. Now the child is back to school, in a normal school and living a normal life. So I think it can work if we put it as a long-term project.
Now, what advice would you give to people who have fallen victim of the failure of the society?
Well, my advice for them is, things could still be better. Because the truth of the matter is they are bitter. They feel every other person is out there to victimize them. You know, but my advice to them is that, you know, people don't hate you. The world doesn't hate you. Society doesn't hate you. You're just a victim of circumstance. It wasn't your fault that what happened. But I believe there are still people out there who love you. There are still families out there who want you. There are still people out there who feel you are somebody, and you can be a better person. You can still achieve your dreams. Your dreams can still be fulfilled. If you wanted to be a doctor before whatever truncated it happened, you can still be a doctor if you have the right perspective, if you still believe that out there are still people out there who love you, and you can still be what you always dreamed to be.
Thank you very much, Justina.
All right, Oscar. We'll take care.
Okay, that was Justina Chita Iregbu, who wrote The Death of Innocence. Some very interesting questions there, some very interesting responses. But I have here in the studio with me a young man who is in high demand, a public speaker, a youth leadership coach, human development consultant, a youth development trainer, and has extensive experience in creating and facilitating youth-led projects. Now, he's been nominated for various youth awards. In 2007, he made the shortlist for the Youth Advocacy category at the Future Awards, at the Future Nigeria 2007. And he also participated in a British Council-sponsored youth exchange program called Belongings in August 2007 in London, UK, and was selected as one of the 101 young African leaders at the African Business Forum in Ghana. Recently, he graduated from a peace-building and conflict resolution certification program by the Generations for Peace in Abu Dhabi, I hope I got that right, United Arab Emirates, UAE, in March 2009. And basically, in conclusion, he's a young person who is passionate about sharing ideas, gaining new skills that will further boost his youth advocacy work, and above all, a citizen of the world who thinks beyond ethnicity, religion, with the aims of building a world fit for living. I'm in the studio with Mr. Francis Anyebu. Hope I got that right, Francis.
Yes, of course you did.
Okay, Francis, welcome to the studio. It's lovely to have you in here. Thanks for joining us. And basically, you've heard the call we had. And what's your general take on this particular issue? Let's start with that.
Thank you very much for the question. The story is quite pathetic. Listening to the story, Death of Innocence, actually brought tears to my eyes. for the young man Uche, who had so much dream, who had so much expectation, and just when he was at the prime of his life, you know, he had a dream truncated. It's really, really painful. That's what we have happening in our society today, is the reality we face as young people growing up in this kind of country, growing up in Nigeria. These are some of the challenges we face, and we hope, hopefully, in the near future, some of these things will be a thing of the past.
Now, there was an interesting question I asked Justina earlier on about the fact that here's a child who was a victim of the clash. He grew up, became a gangster, started killing, and he, I'm sure, would have killed someone along the line whom also is also a victim, and whoever he is hurt will have put that person in the same position he was in, and it's just like a vicious cycle. So when do you think, or how do you think the cycle can break or can stop?
For me, I understand it's a vicious cycle. I know it's going round and round and round, but for me, I think it can be broken. Basically, it starts with the young man acknowledging what he has done, knowing how far he has gone into crime, realizing that this is a turning point for him as a person. And from that, I think, just like Justina suggested, various faith-based organizations, non-governmental organizations, and the civil society group could do a lot in this aspect. He has to be rehabilitated. He has to be talked to. I've really realized that victims of such crimes and people who have gone through this kind of thing needs an opportunity to be talked to. They don't really need to be blamed at that point in time. They need to be talked to. And I think from that, they really get reintegrated back into the society.
Talking about talk to or youth being talked to, I talked about rehabilitation.
Yeah.
How effective do you think it is to rehabilitate? Do you think they can just, forget the past? Do you think it's easy for them to be rehabilitated?
Yes, it's quite. I think it's going to be very difficult to actually forget the past. It's something we cannot do away with. But I think something that it has already happened, and it's happened already, but he can still be rehabilitated the way I think. Though he's committed a crime, he has to pay for the crime, but I think he can be rehabilitated. It's a question of time. It's a long process he has to go through. Mm. Within a short while, I see him being integrated back into the society, though it's really very hard. But with conscious effort by relevant partners and stakeholders in this, I think he'll get back to the society.
Not just him, but anyone in his kind of...
Just anyone, just about anyone in this kind of situation.
Now, talking about the situation, what do you think is the primary factor responsible for this ethnic clashes? I'm thinking maybe poverty. Do you have any other additions?
Yes, I think poverty, just like you rightly said, is one of the major factors that contribute to this issue that we have in the country today. Aside poverty, too, I think... Like this saying goes, an idle mind is a devil's workshop. Sometimes when people are really idle, they try brutal in being involved in nefarious activities. Just like something I did recently in the peace education program you mentioned with the Generations for Peace in Abu Dhabi. Some of the things we sat down and we looked at from various from participants coming from various conflicts prone communities. One of the things we sat down to realize was we noticed that most of these things often trigger from tribal issues, and then degenerate into bigger issues like what we had in the story.
Okay.
And for example, I had this personal experience. I met one of this young chap who actually experienced this thing firsthand. He was staying in the northern region some time ago, and it was during one of those religious crises then. The same people he actually grew up with were the same people who wanted him dead. You know, they started hunting, they chased him, he had to jump, scale a fence, and that was the only thing he needed to do at that point in time. And that was just that single thing that saved him, Just imagine people you grew up with all your life. Just at that point in time, you became someone else, you guys never became brother.
Is it that they were from different tribes or something?
Yes, they were from different tribes. He's actually a Yoruba, and he has grown all his life in the northern part of the country. Just at that point in time, the friends he grew up with turning against him and wanting to kill him just because of religious crisis, so to say.
Okay, you met this guy at the United Arab Emirates?
Yes, we did the story, yes.
Wow. Okay. Those of us listening out there, if you want to be part of the show, hit us up on 277-2923 or 277-3923. Okay, I have a very talented young man in here, a man who's been around the world. I'm very envious right now, man. You've been to London, you've been to Dubai. But anyway, he's Francis Anyebo. So if you have a call or if you want to call in to ask him a question about this or a contribution, 277-2923, 277-3923. Still Inspiration FM, Under the Sun is the name of the program. And basically, we're looking at issues from the perspective of Nigerian writers. We just played The Death of Innocence, written by Justina Chita Uwebu. And in a nutshell, it's talking about a child's family massacred in Kano for tribal differences. The son abandons his dream of becoming a pilot and becomes a gangster instead, killing and robbing. We've had a chat with Justina. We played a call, which happened not too long ago, and she shared her views on the issue. And I have in the studio with me Francis, who is a very youthful person, but he's done a lot for himself in a short space of time. 277-3923, 277-2923 is the number to call right here. Okay, I think we have a call here. Let me take this one. Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to Under the Sun. Who is this?
My name is Michael.
And where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Ojodu Bega.
Okay, so what is your question or contribution?
Well, I don't really have much to say, but I just want to tell you that congratulate Mr. Francis. I like what he's doing. He's doing a very good job. Oscar.
Yes, sir.
You two are doing a very good job. Keep it up.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for calling in.
God bless you.
Okay. We have another caller here. Let's see who this is. Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to Inspiration FM. This is Under the Sun. Who's this?
Hello, good afternoon. This is Francis calling from Ikeja.
Okay, Francis, what's your question or contribution?
I wanted to know what our government is doing about this tribalism problem in our land, in our area.
Oh, okay, and is this directed to Francis?
Yes, somehow.
Somehow, okay. Thank you very much for calling in.
Yeah, welcome.
Now, it seems this caller is very particular about the issue of the government and what the government is doing. I know you're not the government, but what's your take on this?
Yes, I believe the government has a huge role to play in this as well. But where I just find fault with the government was in the case of the NYC killing, when we lost like two chaps serving the country, you know.
When was this?
Incident, you know, the recent just crisis we had, you know. What I felt was that the government wasn't really proactive enough in that. I think a one-page advertorial would have done a whole lot. I think they should have come out in the open and addressed this issue. That would have helped address this plight. And looking beyond mentioning leaders, I think bulk of responsibility lies in us as young people, as youth out there, to actually address this problem. So when you keep mentioning leaders, I think we need to actually take responsibility for our actions, you know.
And I know you've been around, and I'm sure you must have come in contact with you know, state, federal, or local government, someone in the corridors of power. What has been their take on this issue of tribal differences? Do you think there's hope? Do you think they're doing something constructive, or is it just talk?
For me, I think most of the I've been privileged to have come in contact with a lot of leaders, including world leaders as well. But for me, on the national scene, I think they're doing a whole lot. And I think they've been sincere in their efforts to ensure harmony in the country. And around the world, I've seen world leaders too, and I've spoken with them. Their take on this is just that it's peace is non-negotiable. I think we have to live together as brothers. All men are brothers, and we have to live together as brothers. So I think they're actually addressing this.
And what is your advice? Because it's not just the government, you know, people also have a role to play. What's your advice to the youth, people who have gone through this tribal issue? People are hurt by the fact that they've lost loved ones to tribal clashes. What is your advice to them?
Yeah, my advice to the youth out there and other people who have been victims of tribal crises and differences, I think what you need to do is just very simple. Just like Mahatma Gandhi said in his famous quote, you have to be the change you desire to see in the world. We can live this change. If we're so passionate about this change coming to our various communities, in spite of the huge challenge we've had in the past, we can still live together as brothers. We can still decide to live as change agents in our communities so that we don't have the same problem that we've had in the past. But I think our own generation of young people, we're actually bridging this gap. We've done a whole lot in this aspect. compared to the older generation. And with us on our own path, I think we're going a long way.
So what you're saying is that this tribal thing is decreasing with our generation. It's not so prominent as it was in the past generations.
Yes, exactly. I can see it's not like what we used to have in the time past, because I've got friends across the country, I've got friends around the world, you know. We've breached the gap, you know. In the days past, most of our parents and the older generation keeps building walls around themselves, but now we build bridges and we're breaking the barriers of tribal differences in our generation.
That's good. Well, who am I to argue with you? You've probably seen a lot of youths across the world. Thank you very much for joining me in the studio, Francis. Just had Francis Anyuebo, who is basically a guy who is in hot demand, a youth who is just pushing on with his mission to make sure that he goes beyond ethnicity, he goes beyond religion, and his sole aim is of building a world fit for living. Thanks a lot, Francis.
Thank you.
Okay, still right here under the sun, and don't forget, this features the best of contemporary Nigerian writing brought to you by the British Council. Now, the series was devised by Graham Mort and produced by Chidi Oku, and the broadcast is an output from the Radiophonics Project funded by the British Council. The views expressed are not necessarily those of the British Council. Okay? Under the Sun will be coming up same time next week at 1 p.m. right here on Inspiration FM 92.3. Stick around right here. We're still going on with the programs of the day. Thank you very much to all of you who called in, and have a wonderful afternoon.
92.3 Inspiration FM, Nigeria's number one.